This episode of the Cosmosis Podcast is brought to you by Low Vintage Instrument Company, located in downtown Burlington, North Carolina. Follow them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and visit their website at lowvintage.com. Not only do they have some of the finest new and used instruments you'll find anywhere, but they also have the great accessories that you need by some of today's top brands. So find your timeless tone today at lowvintage.com, that's lowevintage.com, and tell them you appreciate their support of the Cosmosis Podcast. Welcome to the Cosmosis Podcast. This is episode number 32, and it's going down at the very last minute possible to get it out on the day that I would like to release the podcast. And with me today is the frequent guest host, co-host, Sierra Hall.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Back again.
Back again.
They're like, not her again.
Hey. You know, I don't think anybody's thinking that because we're here to talk about what we've been doing and to answer some listener questions.
Yeah, that's true. We just got back from the first leg of the fall tour that,
right.
I guess, first kicked off in Philly and New York. Then we got to come home for a couple days. And then we just came back from about 6-7 days out west.
Mm-hmm. Get to come home, and I've spent all day today trying to unclog a drain.
Good times.
Very good times. Very good times. And that's why this podcast is going down at the hour it is, as we watch the Cubs and the Indians on our monitor here.
They're on the screen in the background.
And so if you download this and listen to it tonight, you're not going to get a more live episode than what this one would be. So hopefully couple of you will notice that it's there tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, let's talk a little bit about those dates we just came back from.
Yeah. We started in California and kind of worked our way up to Washington and then come back down to Oregon.
Well, we did the date in Oregon in between as well. So we went north and then back south.
Right.
Yeah. So, what stands out about some of those dates we played?
Well, the only one I had done before as far as the venues was the show in Chico, which is where we started out at the Sierra Nevada Big Room.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that, it had been several years since I'd been there, but, you know, fitting venue for me since it has my name in the title, I thought. Sierra at the Sierra Nevada Big Room. And it was fun. I mean, that's a cool venue. Good crowd, you know, in a beautiful part of California. I always love going out west. So I enjoyed that one for sure. Actually, all these shows on this run, I felt like were really fun in their own way. The next night we were in Ferndale. Had never been to this venue. It's called the Old Steeple. It's an old church that the Ferndale Music Company has purchased and turned into a venue, and possibly the most fun crowd. I mean, all the crowds were cool in their own way, but that crowd stood out to me as being just a crowd that really seemed to get what we were doing. You know, they were really good listeners in the quiet moments, and they were really energetic in the moments that were meant to be energetic. It felt like they were with us the whole time and very present. And that's always fun as a performer, you know, because sometimes you have crowds that are really quiet and you can tell they're really listening, or they feel in certain situations they're a little more respectful, they're not as loud. And then sometimes you have a little bit more rowdy crowd. So they were kind of a good balance of all things, I thought, in Ferndale.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic because not only do crowds have their own personality, but from show to show, I'm sure we as performers sort of do too, and it's an interaction always. It is,
and I think the
venue... You get something back and forth, you know, between the audience and what energy you're putting out too.
I think the style of the venue affects the reaction people give too. Like, if you go see somebody at a symphony hall, like I remember we saw... we got baseball on in the background here, but we saw Sam Bush play at the Skirmerhorn here in Nashville, which is the symphony hall. And it was part of an Albert Pujols. Pujols? How do you say it?
Pujols.
Pujols. Oh, I knew I'd probably say it wrong. But anyway, his foundation did a show, and a charitable show here in town. And Sam, of course, is big. Fan, so he was there being part of that. And you know, we see Sam most of the time in the context of
a festival,
festivals where he's like closing out the show or the night. And you know, it's like there's, you know, hula hoopers and there's, you know, really loud excited fans. And this was much more of a, you know, different kind of atmosphere to see someone like him perform. So it's interesting how both the crowds are different everywhere, but if you took those same people and you put them in a different environment that wasn't like a symphony hall, this real beautiful, elegant atmosphere, and you put them out in the middle of a field at this festival where instead of wearing sports jackets and, you know, dresses, they're wearing camping outfits. I mean, you know, it's a different experience.
Certain altogether. Things do just seem to work better in different environments. I know that night it just felt a little like the crowd couldn't possibly bring the kind of energy they normally would at a festival just mm-hmm. because of the building they were in. It just seems inappropriate almost to
act
the way that you would act at a festival.
I'm sure, you know, without doubt they were loving everything Sam was doing. Right. And it was an exciting night of music. And I think everybody had a great time. It's just a different atmosphere, like you're saying. So anyway, going back to that.
The old steeple, though, is a great atmosphere for the kind of thing that you're doing.
It is, because, you know, it's this
old church.
It wasn't
huge, you know, it's not a huge building.
Probably seats about 300 people, maybe.
And it was pretty full. Was that a sellout?
I can't remember. It was very close
to it, if not. But, yeah, so the space was filled nicely, and it was very much... We could see the audience there.
Yeah.
So there was that kind of interaction. And yeah, it's just, like you said, a listening crowd.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But responsive.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and we played around. We didn't use, I guess you didn't use any ear monitors that night.
No, I love that. Now, I will say, like, for people listening that don't know what our normal setup is, we usually have in-ear monitors, so I have a monitor in my ear, and I'm hearing, you know, the music coming directly through the sound system wirelessly into my pack, and then with headphones into my ear. So,
as opposed to a monitor on
right,
the floor,
it's very
like
direct.
A lot of people use.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's very direct, and you have these things in your ear, so it can sometimes cut off a little bit of your vibe with the crowd if you're not careful, depending on the atmosphere. And so
it can start to feel more like you're in a studio setting, kind of just playing music like that rather than a performance if you're not careful.
Well, and which at a big festival or a big room, like we played a couple, I guess several of the rooms on this tour were bigger kind of rooms that you almost needed to have something.
Yeah.
You know, like that would have been difficult to not have a monitor, for example.
Right.
So, and with the in-ears, we're able to have, like, you hear what you want to hear, I hear what I want to hear, Ethan hears what he wants to hear.
We have our own mixes, and mm-hmm. that's a big deal. And it cuts down, like, if you're using monitors on the stage, the sound from the monitor comes back in and feeds back through the microphones, and it causes more feedback. And
it makes Jason, our sound engineer's life, a lot easier for getting a good front of house mix without having that interference. And then also for us, can cut down on, sound check times. It can cut down on, you know, at a festival when you don't have a lot of time to set up. You can kind of, you know, honestly, I could not sound check at all on my end and feel pretty good most of the time.
Because our mixes...
Because they're so consistent with the same...
Usually the pretty close to the same.
Yeah, with the same microphones, the same mixes. Now, from room to room, that varies. But mm-hmm. then a room like the old steeple, the one we played, being an old church, it was a very lively room already. So we just used a couple of your Trumpet Lab microphones and gathered around, of course... You and I singing into the same microphone yeah. is, you know, quite different just in from a performance standpoint and just being able to really naturally hear each other sing right. together. Like, that's always really fun. And so I think I did use one ear. I had one in just, you know, mm-hmm. just to hear my voice a little better. Standing next to the banjo is, you know, pretty loud.
So, yeah. Well,
but fun. I mean, it's really fun.
But being able to hear without anything in my ear, without any like headphones in my ear, being able to hear you acoustically and just respond to that and hear the audience naturally as well.
Yeah.
Was just that if everything could be like that, I would prefer it. But like you said, it's not, you can't really do that in a lot of the places we play, bigger places and things like that, because if you tried to do that, the sound that we're making on stage sometimes is overcome by the sound coming through the speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sound, if there's things it's bouncing off of, is delayed. And so we wouldn't be playing with each other, really. We'd
right.
be playing with what happened, like, you know, a half second ago or, a, you know, a whole second, you know, depending on the amount of
mm-hmm.
Reverb.
Right. And then, like, the next two nights were rooms that were quite larger. And so we ended up doing our full kind of regular setup for those.
It always makes me laugh because it's really just two more mics than what we have.
It is, but it's still quite different.
It is totally
like
yeah,
I'm singing in a completely different yeah. microphone, so for me it feels a lot different singing mm-hmm. into, you know, a Neumann as opposed to like the more condenser style of the Ear Trumpet Lab. Like with the Neumann, I'm kind of having to sing right in that microphone, as you know, opposed to the other setup and having a little bit more distance between myself and the microphone. It's
right.
just a different feeling all the way around, performance wise. But anyway, the next night we were in Eugene, and you posted a picture of that room. But what a cool venue that was. The Holt Center for Performing Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, this beautiful, I don't even know how to describe it for
go to
people
my Facebook
that are listening.
Page, yeah. Justin, Facebook.com/JustinMoses.
Yeah,
music,
go check it out.
And look at the photo or look up the venue. Actually, we were playing in a, they have a bigger
they have,
room too.
They
right?
have maybe even more than two.
Yeah.
But they host a lot of different things from music to comedy to the night we were there. They also had a symphony show going
night.
On that same night. So mm-hmm. they had that going on across the way. We were in a room that was about 400 so seats.
Yeah.
And then the other one was like 2,500, you know, where the mm-hmm. symphony was. So they host a lot of different things, but just, I mean, beautiful place with just a really, really cool atmosphere for performing.
So that was Eugene, Oregon. The night after that, we played in Kirkland, Washington. And what's the name of the venue there?
The Kirkland Performance Center.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just outside Seattle.
That was a great time.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that show. Really, again, another really good crowd. A lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the thing, too, about playing those PAC, you know, Performing Arts Center dates is like, you know, we've spent all summer playing festivals, so this is kind of the first run of getting back into playing indoors. We finished up our last festival date, I guess, IBMA, you would say.
Yeah.
Playing outside there. So that was our last outdoor show. So getting back into, you know, the theater world for the fall is, you know, it's a different kind of thing. And I always really enjoy that. I mean, I love festival season as much as anybody, just, you know, socially and the whole experience of getting to see all your friends and hear other bands play. But then it's kind of nice to, like, go out and be on a tour where you roll into the venue, do your sound check, dinner's at the same time every night, the show's, you know, usually around the same time every night. You have your show kind of, your time allotted, and it's a consistent kind of thing that you don't get as much at festivals, you know. Yeah. So I kind of enjoy that, from getting a good long sound check if you want it and all that, you know.
Yeah, one of the things that we did that was a lot of fun on this run was to, like, we've been doing the mandolin duet, whatever you want to call it, for quite a while now, and we've played Cattle and the Cane a lot. You know, a lot of people maybe that have come out to our show have seen us play that a couple of times.
Petty on the Turnpike for a little while.
Yeah, we played that. We started doing that a few times this year, but we didn't do it a bunch. But the other night I suggested, like, well, let's see if the crowd has something for us. And so I think every night on this whole run we did a different tune, didn't we? Except for we repeated Old Dangerfield.
Because it got requested twice.
But that we also did another tune in addition to it.
Mm-hmm.
So We still did something different, at least in all of them.
So I guess by the end we were asking for two songs and playing at least two tunes.
Yeah, putting them together.
That was really fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, I was going to just bring that up because it brings a fun thing to the show. Now, when we go play a show, like most every show basically is things that we have played before, we have worked out like how we're going to do them. Like, this is how we're going to perform this song.
Well, sure, and there's like plenty of moments of improvisation, but right. There's a lot of, especially the music I'm performing now, that there's a lot of arrangements that are meant to be the same from night to night.
And right.
The songs are written to be such that you hear this section of the song the same way every night and so forth.
Like,
and
you say, though, there's solos in some of the songs. So,
oh yeah, totally.
Then we don't play them the same every night, but the structure of the set is such that it's mostly that sort of stuff. It was fun, though, to get to do this one
that was just piece completely unexpected, yeah, just and off the cuff,
yeah,
and not know what they were gonna
right
suggest. Mm-hmm. But you know, they, I mean, and
they only asked for one, I think, that we didn't know.
Yeah,
on
you're right. And Olympia. I was like, I have no idea what that song is. I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah,
it's like, well, we'll have to learn that one. But yeah, but most people just, I mean, really just throwing out requests for your standard kind of fiddle tunes. You know, we played everything from Old Joe Clark to Jerusalem Ridge to Cherokee Shuffle.
Yeah.
Whole slew of
everything
things we
in
played.
Between. Yeah. So after we played in Kirkland, we played in Ethan's hometown, basically, of Olympia, Washington.
Mm-hmm. First time that we
that?
Had... We'd played in Washington several times, since performing with him, but first time we had actually made a stop in his hometown. And originally, I usually tell my booking agent and management, you know, when we're out on a run like that. I mean, everybody knows if you're out on the road and you're out west, you're not going to be able to go home. And so any day that you're not working, in a sense, is a day you're spending money to be on the road. You're still paying for hotels. You're still paying for rental vehicles, you're still paying for all that stuff. But as a singer, I don't like to push myself much more than about 5 days in a row if I know I'm going to be singing a ton. And not only singing, but all the talking. We always go out to the record table afterwards. And so we had already played Chico, Ferndale, Eugene, Kirkland, and we were going to have, when we already had a show booked the next night, or I guess the day of the Olympia show, maybe was going to be a day off, and then we were going to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have put us at 6 days in a row, six shows in a row, which can end up being a lot. And we knew if we took a day off in Olympia, well, that'd be fun and everything because it'd be Ethan's hometown. Maybe that would just be a good day to be off there and visit with his family and that kind of thing. And then we got presented with an idea to maybe play one of Ethan's local spots that he grew up seeing music there and has played many times before. It's a place called Traditions Folk Art. And it's like a cafe during the day, and they have a really tiny stage. Both shows sell out at 85 people, so we did two shows both with 85 people packed in there. So really small shows, but kind of fun. Again, just set up a couple microphones and gathered around, and absolutely no ear monitors, but yeah, so we decided to do it, to go ahead and play on that day and do two shows. So really, in some ways, we ended up kind of putting more into one trip than we normally would work-wise. Just because, you know, it would be fun to get to do something in his hometown. And they ended up being really fun, really chill. We played, I guess, two 75-minute sets that night for two different crowds. So,
And we did visit with Ethan's mother, and yep.
She made a great brunch for her.
That's right.
On Sunday. For her, for us. I mean, I guess she had some too.
Yeah, for all of us.
Oh, yeah. Some apple cider. I'd like to have some of that right now. That was good.
Yeah.
And we had to play with the dog. We had a good soccer match with the dog. But yeah, man, Washington's so beautiful this time of year. I mean, just being out in the backyard with just, you know,
well, seeing all the leaves changing. Well, I must say the highlight of that whole deal the second day was Jason almost going into the fish pond.
Oh, yeah. And well, so I had, the folks from GoPro had sent me a camera to capture some tour footage, and which was really awesome of them. And so Jason's kind of our tech man, and he's like, you know, trying to figure out how to use this. It's like their new model, so just trying to figure out how to use it. And so he was videoing us playing. It was I guess there were four of us playing with the dog Arashi.
just kicking the ball around.
And gosh, Arashi loved it so much. And so we were just kind of all spread out kicking the ball back and forth. And so somebody kicked it kind of up pretty high, and Jason, who was actually filming, had the camera in his hand and was kind of paying attention to that. He hadn't actually been kicking the ball or anything, but it kind of came his way, and he thought, okay, well, I'll kick the ball. And he backed up.
Well, he didn't kick it, actually.
No, he was trying to go for it.
It was high in the air, and he used his hand and just kind of
was going to hit it
tipped
back.
Tipped it up, and it went backwards a little bit, and so did he.
Well, there was some cross ties right behind him from that sort of was where she had like a little section, kind of a little area in the garden kind of sectioned off with this little fish pond kind of thing, and boy, he just about went right in the pond.
He landed right on the edge of it.
Yeah, it was a close call, and he happened to be filming the whole thing, so it was pretty hilarious to see the camera just
keep
go
checking
up
online.
In the air. And
at some point, that may be have to be posted in some sort of highlight video from, because we have a lot of video because you had the camera, right?
Oh yeah, we've got loads of video from that.
Took some pictures and did some filming in the some of the redwood. What was the name of the little stop?
Jedediah Smith, maybe, or something. Redwood National.
It was the day we were leaving Ferndale, right?
Mm-hmm.
And heading to Eugene, we kind of stopped off and took some pictures with those. Because for us living out here, like we don't see trees like that.
I've played in California a ton, and I've played in Washington a good bit too, but had never actually made that drive from California up through Oregon and Washington. And so I'd always wanted to see the redwoods. And that was probably the first time I had really got to see them up close like that. I mean, gosh, and that's something else. Oh, and this tour marked my first time being able to be a driver on a tour, to be old enough to finally rent a car. So I turned 25
Sierra
back in September.
Officially 25.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
25. Old enough to rent a car without a...
Old woman.
Without having to pay more.
Yeah, it's like it's affordable now to rent a car. I mean, I've rented a time or two before, but never on our trips because, you know, there's always been Jason or you. Jason's normally our main driver, so kind of fun, though. And, of course, I got to break in that driving through the Redwoods, which is... Ooh, curvy.
We took some curvy roads.
It was just curvy.
We may not have had to, but we did.
Which, you know, honestly, don't really bother me that bad because I grew up in Byrdstown, Tennessee, where it's just, you know, back roads and curves and stuff. But when you're driving and you got a weighted down minivan with instruments and gear and passengers, you know, you have to take it easy and
try not to
make people sick.
It bothers me, and it bothers me more than it seems like it ever used to.
Oh, I definitely get bothered by it more than I used to. I used to, when I was living at home and was a kid and stuff, we could drive up Angel Mountain, is this really curvy road between Byrdstown, where I grew up, and Jamestown, where the rest of our family lives. And golly, I mean, I could sit back there and read a book, and it never bothered me. And now it's just like, look at the road, look at the road. You know, I can't hardly do it, but. Anyway,
yeah,
just wanted to point that out, that I'm a big girl now.
So we finished out the run in Portland, and for us, Portland means one thing.
Voodoo Donuts.
And why does it do that?
Well, so we discovered Voodoo Donuts when we last played a show in Washington. I guess that was that last year or was that this year?
It was last year.
It was last year, but flying out of Portland was the closest airport to where we were in Washington.
Right.
So we had gone to the airport and checked in, and I kept seeing all these pink boxes that all the passengers were taking with them, and I was like, "What are the Voodoo Donuts? Like, what is this?" You know, every other person I felt like was bringing a big thing of Voodoo Donuts home.
I knew what they were before, though, because I'd never heard of it. I'd seen it on either like the Food Network or one of the Travel Channel shows had featured them on it, and so for some reason that one had stuck with me, and I remembered. You know, I had it in my mind if I ever went to Portland and had time that was something I would like to check out.
Yeah.
And then our flight got canceled.
It was just me and you for some reason. I guess Ethan had stayed out.
Talking about the last time we were out there, not this time.
Yeah. So Ethan, living in Washington, he stayed out on the West Coast just like he did this time. He's still out there right now visiting with family rather than coming back with us. So, and Jason, our sound engineer, lives in Atlanta, so he's always flying to
Atlanta.
Different
flight, uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's just me and you, and our flight got canceled for some reason. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember why, but it was kind of early in the day when our flight was, and so we had all afternoon, all evening to just be there. So they put us up in a hotel, and
it was probably 5 or 6 o'clock Pacific time.
And we were kind of delayed and finally canceled.
So we took a trip over.
So I was like, I want to know what's up with this Voodoo Donut. And so
to the original.
We rode the train, I guess, downtown and had ourselves. And let me say, he had heard before about the maple bacon donut being kind of like one of their more famous donuts. And I remember thinking, ugh, that doesn't sound very good. I don't know. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like bacon, like everybody does. I do. But I thought, ew, bacon donut? Like, that don't sound good to me for some reason. It does right now, because after I had it, I remember I got a couple donuts, you got a couple donuts, and we sort of ate them over the next couple days. If they lasted that long, I can't remember if they did. But anyway, we shared.
Yeah, we like
We split them in half and each tried some of the others. So I got, I can't even remember what I got. Like, one of them might have been the Voodoo Donut.
Yeah.
And then another one was like, I think I got the Portland cream, and then you got the bacon and something else. But anyway,
knowing me, it was probably raspberry filled or something like that. Probably, that's what I usually go for.
Well, let me just say, the bacon maple donut was by far the best out of all we had, and I was so surprised at how good it was. And so we had time to go back this trip, and I told Jason, like, we've got to go by Voodoo. You've got to try Voodoo Donut. And I don't know that he was really thinking the bacon donut sounded that good. And he loves bacon now. I know he does. And he got one, and he liked it too. It's quite delicious. He brought some home with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the folks traveling through the airport with his little pink box. But yeah, good times. That was good. And then first time playing Alberta Rose Theater.
Yeah.
There. Enjoyed that show. Except for somebody stole one of my hoodies from the record table. That doesn't really happen often.
Right.
That's very, very rare. I guess so hopefully they needed it. So if you're listening to
this podcast and you're the one that stole it, shame on you.
Well,
mail it back.
They needed it worse than I did, I guess. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's something.
It's starting to get cold in Portland. I don't know if those hoodies will keep you warm enough, but hey, maybe it will.
We've not really experienced a whole lot of that. We've left a lot of things at different places this year.
Oh, I don't even want to talk about all the things I've left or lost on tour this year. It's depressing.
Well, not just you, but, you know, Jason's lost a couple of pretty nice items.
I know. It's
it's
rough.
I think we all have. I think I've been probably the most fortunate. I don't think that I've left anything very significant this year.
Yeah. I mean, and occasionally you can get it back. Like, you know, I lost my favorite water bottle that I got at Rocky Grass last year, and it was, you know, it was a canteen, clean canteen, like, yeah. Thermos kept stuff so hot or cold. And of course I got another one at Telluride this year, but it's not the same, you know. The top doesn't seal. It was more like for coffee and stuff. Mm-hmm. And just has like one that sticks on top, so just still not one of those that you can just throw in your backpack and not worry about it spilling. And so I had mine at Dale Fest, and some guy had just gave me a really epic Dale McCurry sticker, and I put it on my water bottle, and I was so happy about my water bottle, and I lost it. I know it
somebody
sounds,
out there somewhere has silly. That one too.
I think somebody snatched that one too, to be honest.
Yeah.
But then I that same trip lost a jacket at the airport in Baltimore that I had put my jacket on the back of my suitcase. And it's one of those things, we have so much to carry. I mean, usually in a given time, I'm carrying a backpack and or electric mandolin in a gig bag. I've got my mandolin. I've got my octave mandolin, which is kind of in a guitar case, like a flat case. And I've got a suitcase. On this run, I also had an extra merch pelican case. So there's always so much stuff. And in the summertime, like, I freeze on flights, so I always try to bring a jacket or something. So, but the problem is you don't really have anywhere to put it if you're not wearing it. And so it was too hot to wear it in the summer, you know, after Dale Fest. And so I kind of just laid it on my suitcase as I was rolling it, and didn't realize that I didn't have it until I was standing in line to board the flight. And I went, oh, I bet my jacket fell off my suitcase as I was, like, getting out of the car and walking in the airport. So it's not like I could go out of security. And also left another thermos that was, like, one of my favorite ones for coffee. That was, like, a sealed one. Sitting in the bathroom, I, like, you know, was by myself, and I went and set it in the corner kind of over by the faucet, because I, you know, it's kind of gross to have to carry something like that in the airport anyway. But I think I was by myself for some reason. Oh, this is when I was going to the UK with Ron.
Oh, you went to the UK?
I did. I did. And, and so I took that, and I set it in the corner, and then I'm halfway in the air and went, where's my coffee mug? Oh no, it's sitting on the counter. Yeah, in the bathroom.
It's unfortunate. It really is.
Yeah, the list goes on and on. Jason left his water bottle at the hotel this time.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily was able, they mailed it to him, so he'll get his back. It'll live to see another trip.
All right, well, let's get into the meat and the potatoes of this episode, which is a few listener questions that I was sent. And I want to say I appreciate that, and I invite you to continue to send them in. And I want to point out that my email address, justin@justinmoses.com, was down for a period of time. It was because I changed over my domain name and I didn't get the email address switched to the new domain for like a couple of weeks. So if you tried to send something in that time and you got the you get the email returned, know that it's back up and running now, and I can get email at that address. So please send your comments and questions to justin@justinmoses.com, and I will get them at this point. So, but I got a couple to the Facebook page, and I'm going to let Sierra read the questions, and I will do my best to answer. Maybe we can get her input on some of them, too. It's they're from Eleanor.
Mm-hmm. So we have three questions, actually. The first one, so I'll just read it down. Hey, Justin, still really loving the podcast. Here's some questions I've got for you. Number one, you, as a working musician, must spend a lot of time practicing and playing material for hire. In a given week or month, do you make time to jam with friends or any set group?
Yeah, and at this point, the answer to that is no. And it's not necessarily that I just choose for that to be the case either. It's just the circumstances that life is that I'm in at this point is that, you know, we travel so much, you know, on the road this year anyway, I will put it that way, that this year's been particularly busy, that when I'm off the road, my time is usually spent doing other things. Or, as she referred to at the beginning of the question, you know, learning some material for something else, you know, some work for hire. Like, for instance, I will say tomorrow being Wednesday, October the, what will it be?
I'm like, let me check the calendar, 26th.
The 26th, I will be doing a show at the Musicians Hall of Fame here in town with Ricky Skaggs, and Bruce Hornsby's going to be there, and they're doing the song The Way It Is, and now I've played that with them, you know, a bunch a couple of years ago, but I'm probably going to spend a little bit of time in the morning playing with that record again, kind of getting it back in my head, like, you know, ideas of maybe what I might want to do. And things like that come up from time to time, so I'm, you know, using my time to learn something like that, or to work on something like that, or occasionally somebody will send me something before I go into the studio. Most of the time I go to do studio work, it's just show up and, you know, hear the song down, either make a chart or read a chart and kind of play along, you know, without hearing it beforehand. But occasionally I hear something beforehand, so that's something I'd have to work on. But other than that, I've not got a steady jam sort of situation, or just a for fun type situation, even though that would be nice. You know, I think that if, you know, that was a possibility, I would be into it. And so maybe that'll come about at some point. But right now, it's not something that I'm actively involved in. You want to throw in anything on that?
Oh, I mean, kind of similar. Today's been one of those days that aside from doing this right here with you, I've pretty much been a vegetable, and I don't typically have too many days like that. But after we landed, we had to get up really early to fly from Portland yesterday morning, and had a pretty long layover in Denver. So by the time we got to Nashville, it was a little after 6, and I had to hurry and rush home and get ready and go downtown to this show that I'd agreed to be a part of at City Winery. It was a Paul Simon tribute show, and of course I only had to play one song, but kind of similar thing. Had to make sure I was kind of prepared for that, and by the time I got back from that last night, I was just whew, toast. And so today I've just napped and trying to get recovered. Now we do have, well, you've got some things going on this week. My schedule is a little more free the next 2 weeks than than typical for me. I have, that being said, I have plenty to do. I have some solo shows coming up in December that I need to prepare for, along with some other things musically that I need to be working on. And then, you know, you're dealing with your drain. I've got plenty of housework that needs to be done, but I'm kind of excited. I'm like, oh, I can put my fall decorations out now, and I might try to carve a pumpkin. So,
yeah.
And, you know, I'll be, I've already got some plans with some friends here in town, but a lot of it is usually just trying to catch up on things at home and trying to visit with friends that I've just not had a chance to see. I mean, I think I told you on this last trip that it's easy for me sometimes to go on a trip and feel like you get so in tour mode that from the time you wake up in the morning to going to bed really late at night, I mean, there's not a whole lot of outside communication with the rest of the world sometimes when you go out and you're just hitting it hard for like a week on the road. I mean, you know, I'll try to call my mama a couple times and, you know, text here and there with a few people. But I mean, usually I'm pretty consumed with the job at hand when out on the road. So when I come home, it's like, all right, time to get back on a work schedule of doing the things that you do when you're not on the road. So I would love to play more, though. Maybe as the holidays kind of roll around, we'll have some. There's some friend kind of jams and people that have their annual holiday kind of parties and stuff. So that'll be fun.
Well, the way that her question was framed there seemed like she sort of meant like a routine, like it's something that happens often. And that would be, I would love to do that, but I would love to do it in the process of like actually maybe working with people to put together
have an
some
end
music
goal in, yeah. in mind. Yeah,
not that I wouldn't do it for fun, obviously, like music is fun, but like at this point I got a lot of other interests too that I like to just pursue when I'm at home. So
All right. Question. So number two, it was really neat to hear from Barry Bells about the Earls recording. I thought it was especially interesting that they went to such great lengths to maintain a somewhat live feel for the recording. Is it typical in bluegrass to record songs on one track, if that is the correct term? I have a ton of other questions about what the commercial recording process is like in general, but I will save those for later.
Okay, so we can both talk about this quite a bit, I'm sure, but typically, in especially modern bluegrass recording, the one track would be used in terms of one instrument, probably, or actually one instrument these days could be several tracks. Individual microphones, but yeah, it would be rare for everybody to record into one mic or one track, right?
Yeah, I mean, it gets done from time to time, but it is definitely more rare, I would say, these days. It all depends on the vibe you're going for.
Yeah,
and so
I don't even know if it gets done these days. You said it gets done. Do you know of anything that's been recorded in the last, I don't know how many years, that's been recorded to just one track?
One track?
Yeah.
Like one single microphone.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I don't know if it was just, probably not just one, but a similar vibe to that, whether you have multiple tracks, but you're recording as though it's
one.
Yeah,
well, that's what I was about to get into. It's a different thing. I want to define the term so that somebody that doesn't know anything about what we're talking about could...
Well, like, for instance, How to Grow a Woman from the Ground, the album Chris Thiele did that essentially became the first Punch Brothers album. They sort of approached it in a live setting, now not just to one track or one microphone, But
no, it's a different thing to sit in a room, like everybody be in one room and have different mics for everybody sit up and then record and have one take be what you hear. Yeah, so like that is done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So similar kind of approach as far as going in and saying, hey, we all have to nail this together mm-hmm. for it to be something we can actually use. It's similar to everybody gathering around one mic, but just sonically you're getting more, you know, out of the instruments and everything by setting up a few mics and that kind of thing and having more individual miking, but everybody's still shooting for that first take because, you know, like right now, we're recording this podcast into two microphones.
Mm-hmm.
You have a microphone, I have a microphone, but we're sitting right next to each other.
Right.
So if I cut you off in the middle of your sentence, that not only you can't just turn my microphone off.
Because it's still going to come through mine.
Because you're still going to hear me in your microphone because I'm in the same room with you. I'm sitting right next to you. But by having my own microphone, we can control the levels. You can hear me more clearly, hear you more clearly than if we were just sitting there both a good distance from one microphone, or we'd have to, you know, move the microphone back and forth, or we'd mm-hmm. have to, you know, work the microphone, and we're too lazy to do that. So
I think most people can tell the difference too. Obviously, like we're doing this podcast like this. The last one I did was with Tim Shelton, and we recorded it live in Raleigh at the IBMA World of Bluegrass, and I didn't have this setup with me, so I just had the one microphone, and so we were just using the one.
Right. Which and works. It well, just sounds
you
different.
You can do it. It's yeah. just much different. But, yeah. So, have you... Well, I'm asking you a question I sort of know the answer to, I guess, but... talk about the differences in the way that you've recorded your records, because most of yours have been tracked sort of live in the sense of everybody being there and tracking, but the one unreleased record that I was a part of that we did, it was more what you're talking about, where we were in the same room. We had a few dividers up and things like that, but mm-hmm. there was a lot of bleed from instrument to instrument, and we had a room mic, you know, that was picking up everything and contributing to the overall sound. But we had to, if you wanted to make edits to anything we did, we had to edit pretty much the whole band. So in other words, like if we record a song and we play it, say we played it, I don't know how many times we did some of them, but say we did it 10 times. Then we went back and listened to those recordings and tried to figure out which one was the best overall. And
say there was a take that was great, except for somebody completely missed a chord
or missed their solo
or had a solo that was better. I mean, it didn't always work either because we weren't recording to a click. We were playing stuff live, but most of it was consistent enough that you could kind of fly in a section of the song. But if you did that,
hold up because we need to explain what that means.
I'm about to. Okay. I'm about to. So when I say that, I mean you have the regular track that we're all listening to and we say, hey, this overall feels really good, but say so-and-so took a guitar solo or something and liked it from the take before better because there was just something so magical about that needed to be the guitar solo. So you can actually go back to the track before and edit, just splice only the guitar part, the solo, but we took the whole band, so not just the guitar track, but every single microphone's recording of that take, and you can actually grab just that section and put it over the top of that same section on the overall track that we like. And so what that might mean, though, is when you get to that, the tempo might change a little bit, or it might work flawlessly. Sometimes it works flawlessly, but it's certainly can be a more difficult way to record and have everybody be happy about every little detail.
Right.
Because every single person really has to perform at a high level, or there has to be some level of give and take.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this thing you did was so awesome that even though I might not have played as good on that particular section as on the one before, we're going to go with the thing you did because that was so magical.
It's a tougher way to record bluegrass in a lot of ways because most bluegrass players are very particular about, you know, what they sound like on each section. And also, it makes a difference, I think, whether it's a something that's very rehearsed or not. Like, we weren't really that rehearsed to go in and try to record that way. But the other approach that's, I would say, more common in bluegrass is to everybody get in separate rooms and be on headphones, try to get a good take, and then anybody that's not happy with a particular segment of a song, they just speak up at the end and say, oh, I need to redo this.
This section.
This section. And then that can be explained by using a chart. So if everybody has a chart and the engineer has a chart, the engineer being the guy that's in there pressing record and rewind and, you know, getting everything where it needs to be, making everything sound like it needs to sound. You point out a particular bar on a chart and be like, okay, I need to grab that. And so that you go directly to that and redo that section. And that is, I don't know, it's modern technology allows you to do that sort of thing, whereas in the past, people figured out ways to do it. Like, I was listening to a podcast the other day where this guy was describing how Chet Atkins, you know, used to edit things with a razor blade, like tape, actual tape, you know, cutting it. So this is something that's been done for years and years. It's just that now you can do it on a computer rather than...
Well, and another thing is that, you know, a lot of folks simply record this way because it can be a more economical way to record the time that goes into... Like, if you're dependent on, say, five people to go in, gather around one mic, or even say everybody's got their own mic, but if you're in the same room... Like I said, you have to either, everybody has to nail a complete take all the way through and be happy with it. Or you have to be completely consistent enough that you can go back and forth between live takes and them work to become one track. And that can just simply mean a lot of takes and a lot of time sitting there. Whereas if... you go in and you record and everybody's isolated, there is kind of, it's a different sound. It can be sometimes be a cleaner sound for sure. Sometimes not as cool of a sound. Sometimes there's something really awesome about everybody being in the same room. But you don't have to have every single person be flawless on a takedown. It's like if somebody plays the song all the way through and they get it, you know, right, well then they don't have to sit there and
keep
doing it over and over and over at the sake of somebody else missing a certain part or whatever. Mm-hmm. Instead, it can be like, okay, well, these four people got everything right and the fifth person sees a mistake that they want to fix and then they can just do that, which really speeds things up in a lot of settings where people are just going in and they're making a record and they don't have the time or the budget to to deal with letting everybody sit there and try to get things right at the same time.
It's the more common method of getting a record made, I would say, these days.
Right. Yeah. And so typically, you know, in my first two albums, we went in and we recorded the band live. Everything was basically tracked live with the exception of, yes, we were isolated. So if somebody said, let me go back and grab the verse two fills on, you know, on the track. And so you could do that until everybody's happy. And then, but for us, my first record, we tracked everything except for Fiddle and Dobro. Those were overdubs. And then my voice was an overdub, meaning we recorded it after the original track was already finished. So
let me point out, too, that the use of the word track is used for a song.
The overall song
is a track.
Mm-hmm.
And then
there might be 10 tracks that make up a track. So that's the lingo for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that maybe somebody knows more about it to be able to clarify that a little better, because there's probably other terminology that you could use that would clear that up. So on a song, let's say, there could be as many tracks, a commercial recording or a pop record, there's no telling how many tracks, individual tracks, meaning that either a MIDI track or a microphone or
Or layered harmony vocals. I mean, you take some of the pop artists, like, you know, hey, I'll be the first to tell y'all, I'm a big Beyonce fan. I think that she's a amazing vocalist, and like, she's somebody that can go in and she's pretty genius, honestly, at being an artist that can go in, cut a live vocal, and also add her own harmony vocals, because she knows exactly what she wants. So she can go in and build all these interesting harmony vocals behind, and you know, I just use her as one example, but most people in the pop world, a lot of country albums, anything that's got a lot of instrumentation on it ends up having a lot of layered harmonies and layered vocals and things like that, that just in bluegrass music you don't hear as much, because if you went layering a bunch of stuff, it would really stand out, because there's not quite enough instruments on stuff to really...
I've always wanted to do it, though. I've always wanted to make a record where there's a lot more going on.
Well, Allison does that with her albums. That's kind of part of what makes some of the things on her projects so interesting.
And I sort of tried to do that in a sense with, for instance, on my Beyond Measure EP, on the song Beyond Measure, there's, you know, when I try to think of it, you know, I might have a hard time just rattling it off, but there's at least 2 dobro tracks, but I'm not sure whether some of them, one or two of them may be mono, and one or two of them may be stereo. And if it's stereo, that means I had 2 mics on it. And but I had 2 dobro tracks, a Weisenborn, a regular guitar, the bass, and I had like 2 or 3 different mandolin tracks with different things on them. One was just a chop, I think, and then I had some fills on a different track. And so even on that, I had a pretty large number of individual tracks for what is coming out, you know. On your records, how many tracks would you say on a given song? Let's just take Weighted Mind, for instance, the record.
It depends on how many mics you have on the particular instruments. On the bass alone, we had 4 mics and then 2 mics in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like 6 mics just on the bass. Now, that doesn't mean every song had them mixed in.
Right.
So the volume might not be turned up on these mics, or some songs we might have said we're not even going to use that, but we recorded it to have it as an option. And most of that was because some of the songs he's playing pits, which means he's playing with his fingers, you know, and actually playing the bass with his fingers, and then he...
Thumping it.
Yeah, thumping on the bass. And then other songs he would be using the bow. And so the Arco tracks, we'd have 2 other mics. That way we could have stereo sound, like what you're talking about. We wanted the record to sound really full, and because it was mostly mandolin, bass, and voice, there was a lot of room for spreading things out.
Mm-hmm. So I hope, in the course of all of that we answered your question, but it would be rare for everything to be recorded to one track. There are some records that are recorded pretty much live on separate tracks, and that's sort of what Barry was talking about with the Earls. Theirs was recorded very, very live, but not to one track.
Right.
right, third question.
And final question before I forget. What format of music purchasing goes the longest way towards supporting the artists? I often wonder whether I should forego downloading songs on iTunes in favor of buying CDs from the artists I support. Is there a format that maximizes the amount of money the artist gets?
Very good question. And the answer to that is pretty straightforward when it comes to what, you know, gets the artist the most money, and that is buying a physical CD, an album, whatever, directly from the artist at a show. That's where they're going to get the most out of it financially. But I will say that buying music on iTunes is also good for an artist because of the same reasons that I ask for people to go to iTunes and rate and review this show. If people buy your music on iTunes, if they rate your music or review it on iTunes, like getting a lot of activity on your music on iTunes, since it's such a big format, if you have enough of those things, then you will start to get featured on iTunes and recommended to other people. And that's what you, another thing you want, you know, if you want to grow your music and your audience, you want people to discover your music. And so if you download an album from iTunes from a given artist, I think you're still doing something to help them, just in a different way. You know, it may not be the biggest financial impact. So there is that to consider, I think, sometimes. So for me personally, like if we were just to talk about my music, obviously if someone just buys the music at the show, that's a more direct thing. Even when if you order it online, I charge a little, you know, for shipping, but at the same time, the service that I'm using takes a small percentage of the money, and then I never know when I go to the post office whether it's going to be more than what I charge to ship it. You know, it's usually pretty consistent, but it's supposed to be the same every time, but occasionally the package might weigh a tiny bit different, or, you know, there's some kind of something just a little different that causes it to be a little more. But you have to buy an envelope and to mail it in and stuff like that too. So there's that. And then I have all of my digital sales and everything that come through iTunes and everything like that. I have mine through CD Baby. And so I just get a payment from them every month or every other month. And it just shows up on that when I get like iTunes sales or Amazon or something like that. Do you have anything on that whole discussion?
Well, my situation's a little bit different because I record for a record label.
Yeah,
so absolutely. The setup is a little bit different in that I don't fund my own records. The record label does. They pay for the recording. So the money that they have spent is money that they therefore recoup after the record comes out. And they do that a few different ways, but One of the ways they do it is by the CDs that I order to take out on the road. So, for instance, I shipped, you know, a bunch of LPs and CDs out to the West Coast to be there for this West Coast tour. I don't just get those for free, nor do I get them at the price you do because you own your CD and you actually buy your CD straight from the manufacturer. I don't buy my CD straight from the manufacturer. Right. I buy my CD from the record label.
Right.
So they make a profit by charging me a little more than what they actually buy the CD from the manufacturer from.
Right.
So I automatically have more expense in the albums I sell than you would.
Right.
But therefore, I also didn't pay for my album to be made. Right. So they're recouping that. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, they get their money. It affects me eventually. It is like I'm paying for it in the long run. Mm-hmm. But as far as the immediate income, that's how they start making some of their money back. So, you know, you have to take X amount off of every CD I sell as an expense, and it's quite a bit more than what you would have in your albums if you just bought them. Same thing through if someone buys an album through my website. Not only do I have a fee or, you know, an expense in the actual cost of the album from the label, I don't do my own shipping or handle my own merchandise through my website. I have a third party that does that, so they get a percentage on top of that. So I do make money off of them, but you know, I wouldn't say it's a it's not as much as it would be if you just bought it from me at the show.
Right.
You know, buying it at the show, there's no third-party percentage unless sometimes the venue takes percentages. Quite often, the venue will take a percentage on sales.
Right.
And as far as iTunes, I don't see that money from iTunes. The label, anything that you buy off of Amazon or Barnes & Noble, if you go in Best Buy or you go in anywhere that you'd find my album and you buy that, that isn't money that gets directly sent to me. That goes toward the recouping of the album.
Right.
So I make my most immediate income from selling my own albums off my own website and, you know, number one, off of the road. But it helps me just as well for people to buy things, like you're saying, through iTunes and Amazon and all that, because you want to get charted. You want to get your... And also, and the quicker the label recoups, the quicker I make money. After the fact. Exactly, so it's all working together as a good thing at the end of the day. I guess it just depends on, you know, if you buy an album, anytime you buy an album and you're buying my music, you're supporting me in one way or another.
That's what I wanted to get across. More
than streaming it or any like method of hearing it for free or getting it for free. No, I mean, that doesn't directly help as far as financially speaking.
But even streaming, I will say that too. Even that is, I would rather people be streaming my music and listening to it than to not at all.
Yeah, I would agree. Because those are, you know, I have so many people that come up to me at the show that say, I heard you on Pandora. So I discovered your music on there. Or I discovered your music on this Spotify playlist. And that's why I bought a ticket to the show tonight. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who you were, so I looked you up on there and started listening to your music. It is an immediate way for people to go on and check out your music and decide they like it, then buy the album. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of people wouldn't take the risk of spending, you know, $12, $15 on an album that they don't even know if they'd like. I mean, people used to do that, and they just, you know, it's not like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well...
So there you have it.
I hope that, again, I hope that answered the question adequately.
Well, and for every album sold, too, I will say I get mechanical royalties off of every. So the label pays that to me. Even before the recoup, you know.
I was about to say, though, like you pointed out, the venue takes a percentage sometimes. When you point that out, it really made me think about how, you know, some people I will say, will think if a record is $20 or so, let's say at the record table, that's a lot of money for some music, but they don't really even realize like how much you've put into that album. That one, the one I'm saying that's being sold for $20, you have a certain dollar amount just in buying that. And you have amount probably off of what you're selling it for that the venue's
taking. The venue could take anywhere from 10 to 20%.
And let's just say that you use your card, or you use your card reader and they pay for it with a card. Well, there's a percentage taken away from that, too.
2.75, big ones.
So, a lot of that gets eaten away just out of like giving everybody their percent.
And then let's not talk about the hours and labor that you put into it creatively.
Yeah. I think people do sort of understand that, you know, hopefully that, you know, that they don't just happen without a lot of thought and work being put into it.
And I understand, like, you know, if you've bought tickets to a show, to come buy a bunch of merchandise on top of that can be expensive.
Definitely.
You know, it can be money that, you know, you might not have to spend. Mm-hmm. So I always appreciate when people are able to take home music with them, or that they go out of their way to buy a ticket and to take an album home. You know, I mean, more than anything, I've worked hard on my music, so I would rather people have it. Like you said, mm-hmm. I don't want to feel I've put all this work into making music that nobody ends up hearing. So, you know, occasionally I'll have somebody say, like the other night, somebody said, well, I got your earlier record and he got the latest record and we're going to share, you know? So, I mean, financially, if we're really looking at it, that's like they're getting double. They're going to burn the albums to each other's playlist on iTunes or something, essentially, you know? So that's kind of like you got an album for free, you know?
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, do I go, awesome? Not really, but you know what? If they enjoy those albums and it means they'll come back come back to see a show, you know, that's how it goes. So I understand that. It doesn't really make me angry or something. It is, I mean, it would be nicer if everybody would be like, get their own copy, but, you know, I'm also realistic about it too, you know.
Well, Sierra, I appreciate you being willing to help me out on this episode, and it's so much more fun to address these things with a co-host.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm still a frequent listener, so
listener guest.
I don't know if I'll listen to this one. I've rambled a lot, but
all right. Well, thanks a lot.
But I hope they enjoy it.
Yeah. I do want to say that this will probably be the last episode of this show that I release on a regular schedule of every 2 weeks. So if you listen to this and if you listen to this show to this point, I just want to let you know that I'm not saying that the podcast is over, because I still plan to do one whenever the time comes that I can get one out, but I don't want to hold myself to every 2 weeks necessarily. So you may get one, you may get 2 days in a row, you may have a podcast, but you may go, you know, 3 weeks or more without one. So the best way to keep up with the show is to subscribe on the outlet of your choice, whether it be iTunes, Stitcher. If you have the Beyond Pod app on your phone, that's the one I use. I have an Android device, and Beyond Pod works really well for you to just subscribe to a show, and then you can control on there for sure whether you want to automatically download the episodes or just view them. You can view the episodes and choose the ones which you want to download, but do keep up with the show, and I will post on Facebook and Twitter and all that when a new show is coming out, when one is available, and try to keep everybody up to date on what's going on. For Sierra Hall, this is Justin Moses, and I'll see you on the next episode of the Cosmoses Podcast. Thanks a lot. ¶¶